Hi FM, your station of choice since 2008.
It is 8:14. I'm Howard Feldman. A very good morning to you. Thank you for joining us. Also, thanks to Dr. Leonard Carr. He's a clinical psychologist trying to help us navigate some of these terrible, terrible stories. What causes somebody to murder ones that they love? Thanks for joining us. Is it even possible to answer that question?
Howard, it isn't really. I mean, there's not enough information, and if someone doesn't have a history of mental illness that we know about, and they suddenly snap and there'd be no indication, it's very difficult to speculate on what happened.
Yeah, in fact, I had a similar conversation with a friend last week who had lost another friend as a result of suicide. He was feeling terrible about it. Maybe he should have seen the signs. And when I chatted to him through it with him, there were no signs that he could even in retrospect think of, which makes it very, very difficult. Obviously, people have some responsibility to reach out. But here's a situation where we've got this highly functioning, or what appears to be a highly functioning couple, who have three beautiful young children who they've struggled to conceive. They go off and live in another country, and all of a sudden something like this happens. Does it come out the blue, or would there have been signs, not necessarily for the world to see, but for the husband or those around them to have seen?
Well, you see, the danger of thinking that way is that people can sort of become, you know, hyper-vigilant and just see, you know, everything that appears a little bit out of order as a sign, you know, because people are not consistent. And if you look at anybody closely enough, you're going to see signs of, you know, irrational behavior. But I think what can happen, and what very probably happened in this situation, is that a person has an underlying vulnerability, and under sufficient stress, you know, that vulnerability comes out. And the fact that she was referred for psychiatric evaluation immediately tells you that there must have been obvious signs that she was psychotic, that she was not living in reality, you know. It's not like she appeared in court and they listened to her and then they decided. They'd already decided that it was psychiatric before she went to court. So she must have had a severe breakdown. And the only clue that I've been able to find, which is possibly a clue, is that to facilitate their emigration, she had to go off some chronic medication. So it is possible that she was on bipolar medication or something like that. But who knows?
You know, everything obviously operates in the world on some form of spectrum. You know, we like to think that everything's black and white. It really just isn't.
Right.
How far along the spectrum does one have to be in order to kill one's own children? We know that they struggled to conceive. We know, and this is all on the assumption that this is what happened, and that's the information we have in front of us. It's almost a hypothetical, but it's an important conversation anyway, even given the fact that we don't know with absolute certainty what happened. How does she go? How do you go from all the way along that spectrum so quickly?
Right. Well, I think that, first of all, when you say spectrum, it implies that every single one of us is on all the spectrum.
Aren't we?
And, pardon?
Aren't we?
Yeah, we are. I'm saying we
right,
are.
Right, absolutely.
And so that means that we all have vulnerability.
Mm-hmm.
And when you're talking about something like this, and I think suicide as well, even when it was planned, even when they're I'm absolutely convinced that at the moment of someone actually going through with it, they are not in their right state of mind. If someone plans something, it means that at the moment they lost it, they already had rehearsed it, and it was easier to, it facilitates them being able to do it. But I don't think at that moment a person is exercising free will. And if you think about it, just for the average person, when you get into a very stressed out space, into a kind of survivalist state. Your world contracts. In fact, the word tsar, like in Menametzar from the Straits, are called on Hashem. It implies contraction, constriction. So if you think about it, when you're very stressed, your vision becomes tunnel vision. You lose connection with your emotions. Your heart contracts. You don't feel your own reality emotionally. And your whole world becomes like a dark tunnel. And I think that when someone is in that state, they're literally out of touch with reality. And, you know, people forget that I have loved ones, that I have a future. Your time stops. You literally forget every reality about your life. And you move into another space. Now, for most people, that's temporary, and it's not severe enough to take very extreme action. But you can just imagine that if someone's pushed far enough, they can do something out of sheer desperation in a moment. There may have been no signs before, but in that moment, they are so in such a dark space that they don't see anything outside of their infinite presence that they're in.
Is there a common thread, common psyche, a commonality with these family murders? I know that at one stage in South Africa, there was this spate of almost men doing this, but then we've also seen situations where women kill their children across the world. Is there a commonality here?
Well, when there was that spate in South Africa, there seemed to be a high incidence of police officers, and a big part of it seemed to have been post-traumatic stress disorder. You know, but you can't find commonality. Sometimes it's revenge. It's a way of punishing a partner. Sometimes it's a kind of twisted way of protecting the children. You know, if you're in an abusive situation or if you're in dire straits, sometimes people see that as the only way out. There are a multitude of reasons, and I don't think there's any common thread.
Is it more common in some countries over other countries?
With these things, there seem to be trends in countries, and it seems to have to do with, you know, socioeconomic forces and all of that. But the problem also with comparing countries is that the same thing applies to suicide and mental illness. Countries have different ways of reporting and different ways of describing things, you know, so we're not always talking about the same thing, even though it sounds the same.
Right. I remember reading somewhere that in South Africa, because certainly in the white, maybe Afrikaans community, being a Calvinist type of an environment where very, very traditionally the man was in control or head of the household, there was this element of responsibility. And if he couldn't provide in one way, then he certainly could be responsible in others, that could have led to these types of situations. Any truth in that? In those types of theories?
Yeah, it could be. But, you know, the thing is, when people do studies, for example, on serial killers, and you start to interview people, you find that there's not enough commonality to be able to draw those kinds of conclusions. And the problem is also that when you do draw those kinds of conclusions, you stigmatize others. You know, it's easy to come up with a theory, but if one really wants to know the reality, you have to look at it on a case-by-case basis.
What would the signs, and we don't know in this case, but what would the signs be if somebody is living with somebody who does suffer from depression or some form of mental illness, where they should be concerned, or there might be signs that they could look out for to prevent a situation like this happening?
So the one thing is, I mean, one disorder in particular, which is bipolar disorder, people have a tendency to go off their medication. And also, you know, I mean, I have this a lot in my practice, where people say, I'm feeling so well, I've never been better. I think it's time to start going off my medication.
Right.
And I have to say to them, have you maybe made the connection that
between the medication,
you know, it's because of the medication. But also, there's another side to medication that people feel sometimes that they're not themselves, that the medication is taking away their personality or whatever it is. So they, so one has to watch out if someone's going off their medication or not being cooperative with their medication, because there's some medications that if you miss a couple of days, it can cause tremendous instability, from the withdrawal, etc. So that would be one thing. Fluctuations in mood, people becoming, going from a normal mood to irritable and aggressive, or seemingly overly excited and exuberant, whatever it is, fluctuations in mood, someone withdrawing, becoming secretive, anything that's out of the ordinary, people should be sensitive to these things, but not paranoid.
Yeah, and you've mentioned that before, and I think that's an important point. You've emphasized it before, which obviously makes it something worth just talking about, is not to be hypervigilant, because that in itself creates anxiety and uncomfortable. Janine says, I've just switched on. I find this interview very disturbing. Please, can you fill us in the backstory? Janine, the backstory is, and if you have just tuned in, we are talking about a situation in New Zealand where a couple from South Africa immigrated. They came out of quarantine. They were setting up their home, and it turns out, allegedly, the wife took the life of their three young children. The husband came home from work to find that she had killed, allegedly, the children. She's gone for psychiatric evaluation, and we are talking about what brings people to a situation that they might kill or harm their loved ones. Mike says, when you get to the point where the wall of stress, exasperation, and no joy and no vision of any life gets so big you give up, at that moment there is peace and a stillness. That's quite a visual picture there, disturbing in a way.
Right. Actually, there was one other clue I just want to mention, which seems innocuous. And I want to tie in another point that I want to make. The other clue was on her Facebook post. She made a joke, which every young parent makes, about hopefully the children will let us sleep. And chronic sleep deprivation, and especially the unrelenting demand of small children. And now, if you can imagine, 10 days of quarantine in a hotel room with no sleep, and these children, and the husband's gone out, and you've just emigrated. One has to realize that in itself is a tremendous pressure cooker. And I think people have to also realize, because I know this is something on a lot of people's minds, that immigration is not as simple as people think it is. And I don't think that one can begin to calculate the stresses. And if one is going to emigrate, one really has to make sure that you've thought about how you're going to deal with the psychological stress, especially lack of support, because one can imagine.
So, absolutely. And in fact, Leonard, what I'm going to do is I actually want to come back to that conversation with you as a separate conversation. I'm going to ask my producer, in fact, Senna, to speak to you about that within the next few weeks. I would love to talk about that, because I think that there is this trend towards immigration, which might be right or might be wrong for some people, but I don't believe, and this is coming from somebody who's lived both in Israel and the United States and come back, I don't think that people recognize the many challenges of immigration, including the impact on mental health for the entire family. So I do think that this is a conversation that we should be having as a separate conversation. We are unfortunately out of time now, but I'm going to use that as a hook or into our next conversation, which I really would like to have. Leonard Carr, thank you for going through this in such detail and shedding such light on an unfathomable, or what seems to be an unfathomable situation. It's